Rogers and Nixon's coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming for dead in Ohio. For dead in Ohio. For dead in Ohio. For dead in Ohio. For dead in Ohio.
For dead in Ohio.
For dead in Ohio. For dead in Ohio. For dead in Ohio.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to Michelle Alexander explain how the Get Tough on Crime policies that were enacted in the 1970s were an effort to push back on the gains of the Civil Rights Movement. Michelle Alexander is an associate professor of law at Ohio State University.
And prisons today, they are out of sight and out of mind. Often hundreds of miles away from communities and families that might otherwise be connected to them. And the people who cycle in and out of these prisons typically live in segregated, impoverished communities. Communities that middle-class folks, upper-middle-class folks, rarely come across. So you can live your whole life in America today having no idea that this system of mass incarceration and the harm it wreaks even exists. So we have got to be willing to tell the truth about what has occurred, pull back the curtain and make visible what is hidden in plain sight so that an awakening can begin and people can begin to take the kind of creative, constructive action that this moment in our history surely requires. But of course, just a lot of talk and consciousness raising isn't going to be enough. We've got to be willing to get to work. And in my view, that means we have got to be willing to build an underground railroad for people released from prison. An underground railroad for people who want to make a genuine break for real freedom. People who want to escape this system and find work, find shelter, be able to support their families, find a true freedom in America today. We have got to be willing to open our homes, open our schools, open our workplaces to people returning home from prison and provide safe spaces of support for the families who have loved ones behind bars today. How do we create these safe places? Well, one thing we can certainly do, we can begin to admit our own criminality out loud. Our own criminality. Because the truth is, we've all made mistakes in our lives. We all have. All of us are sinners. All of us have done wrong. All of us have broken the law at some point in our lives. If you're an adult, you've broken the law at some point in your life. Now, I find that some people will say, oh yeah, I'm a sinner. I've made mistakes, but don't call me a criminal. Don't call me a criminal. I say, okay, well, maybe you never drank underage. Maybe you never experimented with drugs. Well, if the worst thing you've done in your entire life is speed 10 miles over the speed limit on the freeway, you've put yourself and others at more risk of harm than someone smoking marijuana in the privacy of their living room. But there are people in the United States serving life sentences for first-time drug offenses. Life sentences. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld life sentences for first-time drug offenders against an Eighth Amendment challenge that such sentences were cruel and unusual in violation of the Eighth Amendment. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, it's not cruel and unusual punishment to sentence a young man to life imprisonment for a first-time drug offense, even though virtually no other country in the world does such a thing. So we've got to end this idea that the criminals are them, not us. And instead say, there but for the grace of God go I. All of us have made mistakes in our lives, taken wrong turns, but only some of us have been required to pay for those mistakes for the rest of our lives. In fact, President Barack Obama himself has admitted to more than a little bit of drug use in his lifetime. He's admitted to using marijuana and cocaine in his youth. And if he hadn't been raised by white grandparents in Hawaii, if he hadn't done much of his illegal drug use on predominantly white college campuses and universities, if he had been raised in the hood, the odds are good that he would have been stopped, he would have been frisked, he would have been searched, he would have been caught. And far from being president of the United States today, he might not even have the right to vote, depending on the state he lives in. So we've got to recognize that building this movement is about ensuring the future of all of us, the life chances of all of our young people, so that they can all dream big dreams and join in this project of the American dream. This is a movement we must build on behalf of all of us. It's not about us and them. the people we imagine are the criminals. But of course, building this underground railroad and creating safe spaces isn't going to be enough either. Just as in the days of slavery, it wasn't enough to shuttle a few to freedom one by one on the underground railroad, it won't be enough for us to open our hearts and our minds to a few one by one. We're going to have to be willing to work for abolition. That means working for abolition of this system of mass incarceration as a whole. And that means ending the war on drugs once and for all. Ending it. We must shift to a public health model for dealing with drug addiction and drug abuse and stop investing billions of dollars locking people up in prisons and jail cells rather than investing in education and drug treatment and job creation in the communities that need it most. And we have got to end all these forms of legal discrimination against people released from prison. Discrimination that denies them basic human rights to work, to shelter, to food. And last but not least, we have got to shift from a purely punitive approach to dealing with violence and violent crime in our communities to a more rehabilitative and restorative one. One that takes seriously the interests of the victim, the offender, and the community as a whole. We have got a lot of work to do. And if it seems like too much, if it seems like it can't possibly be done, keep in mind that all of these rules, laws, policies, and practices that constitute this system of mass incarceration, they all rest upon one core belief. And it is the same belief that sustained Jim Crow. It is the belief that some of us, are not worthy of genuine care, compassion, and concern. And when we effectively challenge that core belief, this whole system begins to fall like dominoes. A multiracial, multi-ethnic human rights movement must be born, one that is rooted in the awareness of the dignity and humanity of all people. And it's got to be multiracial and multi-ethnic, because although this war on drugs may have been born with black folks in mind, it is a war that has destroyed the lives of people in communities of all colors. And we see the same get tough rhetoric and divisive racial politics that helped to give birth to the drug war, now leading to another prison building boom, this one aimed at suspected illegal immigrants. So we have got to be willing to connect the dots and build a multiracial, multi-ethnic human rights movement on behalf of all of us. But before this movement can truly get underway, a great awakening is required. We have got to awaken from this colorblind slumber that we've been in to the realities of race in America. And we've got to be willing to embrace those labeled criminals. Not necessarily all their behavior, but them, their humanness. For it has been the refusal and failure to recognize the dignity and humanity of all people that has been the sturdy foundation for every caste system that has ever existed in the United States or anywhere else in the world. It's our task, I firmly believe, to end not just mass incarceration, not just the war on drugs, but to end this history and cycle of caste in America. Then, and only then, can we say with pride that we are finally catching up with King. Thank you so much for having me tonight. Thank you.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Well, okay. I gotta take a moment here. Sorry, folks. Okay, we're gonna take some questions now. If folks wanna ask questions, we have a microphone over here and a microphone over there. You can just come up and line up and begin to ask some questions. If you have any questions for Professor Alexander.
Well, you made a believer out of me. Interestingly, I hear our incarceration rates are higher than what North Korea reports. But that can't really be trusted.
We're the world leader.
What?
We're the world leader in imprisonment.
My question is, among non-drug-related incarcerations, is there still a racial bias?
Well, there are racial biases to be found at every stage of the criminal justice process. And while some of this bias clearly, is related to conscious, intentional biases that are unstated but nonetheless held, I believe that much of the bias is unconscious bias and stereotyping. You know, a police officer who sees a group of young black men walking down the street with their pants sagging down may think to himself, I'm going to do my job. I'm going to jump out, frisk them, see if they got anything on them. Thinking with good intentions, I'm doing my job, doing what I should do to keep this neighborhood safe. Now, that same officer may see a group of young white kids walking down the street, and the thought would never cross his mind to jump out of his car and have those kids spread eagle out on the pavement, frisking them. That officer may not hold any evil intent to those young black men, but those unconscious biases about who looks like a criminal, who seems like they're up to no good, play out over and over again, hundreds of thousands of times in just one city, you know, as I mentioned, adding up to these enormous racial disparities. And the same is true with prosecutors. You know, there's studies published in the San Jose Mercury News, for example, showing that prosecutors display, you know, considerable decisions about who seems like they should be given a good deal, who's worthy of a second chance, who seems like they're, you know, somebody who's just a tough kid who can't be turned around and the book should be thrown at him. So these unconscious biases play themselves out in all kinds of crimes and types of offenses. But, you know, when we talk about violent crime, I think it is important to acknowledge that, you know, rates of violent crime are much higher among black men than among white men. That's a fact. Rates of violent crime are much, much higher. But as William Julius Wilson points out in his excellent book, When Work Disappears, racial disparities and violent crime disappear when you control for joblessness. In other words, if you compare white jobless men with black jobless men, the racial disparity in violent crime disappears. Now, that doesn't mean joblessness is an excuse for violence. No, it certainly is not. And most people who are jobless do not engage in violent crime. But the reality is that joblessness, particularly chronic joblessness, creates the very conditions we know that will give rise to violence and place people at risk of violence. But we've created a system that guarantees that certain populations defined by race and class will be perpetually jobless, will be locked out of the legal economy. And we supposedly do all of this in the name of safety. So we have a system of mass incarceration that exists supposedly to make us all safer, and yet it ensures that this enormous population will be locked out of employment, locked out of housing, and trapped in a perpetual undercast. And then we stand back and express surprise that rates of violence and other crimes are higher in those communities. And in fact, I think we have to ask ourselves, why on earth would we create the very conditions that we know are likely to create violence? Why are we so willing to invest in building prisons rather than in job creation and education, the very things that we know are the ingredients of healthy, thriving, safe, and caring communities? So I think that it's important for us to recognize the ways in which bias plays out, you know, in all these discretionary decisions that are made throughout the system, but it also plays out in how we as a nation invest our resources and who we are willing to treat as disposable and who we view as having a future and deserving of the kind of resources that will ensure them, you know, a path of meaningful opportunity.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Thank you. Hi.
Good evening, Professor Alexander. I had a quick question. You say that we need a revolution. So my thing is, during the era of Jim Crow, you noticed that the financial hardship of creating separate but equal kind of helped to break down the system of Jim Crow. Started writing laws that America couldn't fund separate but equal laws, schools or classroom settings. So with this era of mass incarceration, what are some of the economic kind of things we can use to break down the system? But what you're saying, that it was kind of like this is added to because people are getting paid off of this. And money is getting put into it. So how can we hit them in their pockets kind of thing?
Yes. It's a good question. You know, I mean, I think it's important first, though, to emphasize that Jim Crow didn't collapse because it was too expensive to provide equal educational opportunities for black folks as compared to whites. There was no effort to try to provide equal educational opportunities for black folks in a separate system as compared to whites. What led to the collapse of Jim Crow had a lot to do with how the United States was being viewed in the aftermath of, you know, World War II, when black, you know, servicemen were returning home from fighting for freedom abroad and returning home to suffer second-class status and being hung from trees in the South. And these events were being broadcast around the world, you know, tarnishing America's image as leader of the free world and standing up, you know, against tyranny. And Jim Crow collapsed because of a mass movement that arose that shook the foundations of the system itself. But I agree with you that we can weaken the foundations of any system of control by challenging its economic base. And that certainly was one of the strategies that led to the collapse of apartheid in South Africa. The divestment movement, you know, urging, you know, universities to divest from South Africa, corporations to divest from South Africa, you know, scared the daylights out of, you know, the South African government as they feared, you know, investment being pulled from their country in moral outrage over the apartheid system that existed there. And there are young people today who are talking about pursuing divestment strategies in the era of mass incarceration, meaning divesting from private prisons. The United Methodist Church, actually, the National United Methodist Church, just announced that they have decided to divest from private prisons. You'd say, well, what is a church doing investing in private prisons in the first place? Well, churches, you know, invest in pensions and mutual funds, right? And very often we don't even know what companies our mutual funds are invested in. Well, private prisons have become very profitable, and so many investment portfolios now include private prisons as one of the profitable companies that any institution ought to invest in. And so you can wonder, you know, is this institution that we're in invested in private prisons? I don't know. What churches are invested have funds in private prisons. So I think a divestment campaign urging universities, churches, corporations to divest from private prisons directly, as well as any mutual fund or pension plan that has even one penny invested in private prisons, can be very helpful in crippling the private prison industry. But more importantly, I think it can be a tool for raising consciousness, raising awareness about the system of mass incarceration as a whole. I believe that fewer than 1 in 10 prisoners today are held in private prisons. So even if we got rid of private prisons, we would still have a system of mass incarceration today. But I think that those kinds of divestment campaigns can help to raise consciousness and can be an important part of movement building, as well as boycotting companies that will not hire people with criminal records. You know, there have been a number of companies that have courageously said, we are going to hire people who have felony records. We're going to give people a fair shot at employment. And if we begin to celebrate and honor those companies while publicizing those companies that won't give people even a chance at an interview, even a chance at getting in the door, you know, I think that can be something else that helps to raise consciousness and contribute to movement building. But ultimately, I don't believe that this movement should be about dollars and cents. Ultimately, this, we have got to find a way to build a new moral consensus and build on the work that Dr. King was doing and, you know, force all of us to reckon with what we have done and inspire genuine care, compassion, and concern for the least advantaged in our society. So I think it can, what you're describing can be a part of that, but we can't reduce the movement to dollar and cents.
Thank you so much, Earl.
In your book, you mentioned several judges who've given up their courts, who have resigned because of the harsh sentences they're expected to give for drug offenders. Have any of those judges stepped forward as leaders? Have any of those judges said, my experience gives me a perspective, gives me a sounding board where I can lead people into some of this revolution?
Yes, well, there's a wonderful organization that I would recommend people to check out, which is called LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. This organization is comprised entirely of, you know, judges, prosecutors, police officers, police chiefs, who now believe that the drug war has caused vastly more harm than prohibition itself. And these are people who spent their lives, often their careers, as drug warriors and have come to the conclusion that the harm caused by the drug war is so vastly outweighed by any potential benefits that it has to be abandoned in its entirety. And so you can check out their website. They have a lot of great resources, videos, and the like that really feature some, you know, important voices within the law enforcement community calling for a change in course.
Okay, thanks for pointing to us to some leadership.
Thank you.
Hi, Doc. Growing up a poor man in my younger age, and I was just sitting here thinking about how blessed and fortunate I am to not to be in the system. Mm-hmm. But I also have some acquainted people who I do know that is in the system, sort of by mistakes, and you wonder, these are good people. Mm-hmm. So how do we determine now? I know you spoke on, you fill the application out, and you put in that, yes, I'm a criminal, yes, I've been to prison. How do we get to this point where we can give them a second chance? That's why I can't understand, because my heart really hurt for that. It's one particular guy who I know that's a great guy, made a very serious mistake. Really, he didn't make the mistake. He was just caught up with the person. The person that made the mistake, but he also paid the price.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we turn this around to give this person a second chance?
Well, I think, you know, first, I am a supporter of Ban the Box initiatives. Ban the Box campaigns are campaigns that have been successful in a number of cities and jurisdictions to remove the box on employment applications, asking the question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? I believe the city of Philadelphia has now removed that question from all city employment applications. There are a number of jurisdictions around the country, cities, counties, that have embraced the Ban the Box movement and have removed the box from employment applications. Now, of course, employers may then still consider prior criminal history once the person has had an interview. But what removing the box does is it gives people a chance. Gives people a chance to at least get an interview, at least to get their foot in the door so that they can make their case that they deserve a chance and that whatever mistakes they may have made in the past do not bear upon the current job they're being asked to perform, or that they are well beyond the type of activity that landed them in jail in the first place. And so I think everybody should have that shot. And I also think that, you know, the reality is, you know, for people who are convicted of drug offenses, you know, they're in a position that I think is unfair vis-a-vis those who drink alcohol regularly or who are alcoholics. You know, you have people who have alcohol problems, who struggle with alcoholism. They don't check any boxes. There's no background checks that reveal their history unless they've been caught in a DUI or something like that. And so my own view is that, you know, people who, you know, have some kind of drug-related conviction, these are the types of things that shouldn't be held against people because they happen to be caught. The odds are so vastly higher that you might get caught if you're a poor person living in a ghettoized community as opposed to someone who's on a college campus engaging that kind of activity, and everyone just thinks, oh, they're just being kids and they'll grow out of it. You know, I think that we really have to be very careful about the extent to which we view, you know, criminal convictions as even relevant to the particular types of jobs that people are applying for today. And I support a very strong kind of anti-discrimination position against people who have prior criminal records, unless it is directly relevant to the type of job they're applying for.
Thank you.
President John F. Kennedy, speaking from the White House, announces the introduction of civil rights legislation in 1963.
The events in Birmingham and elsewhere have so increased the cries for equality that no city or state or legislative body can prudently choose to ignore them. We face, therefore, a moral crisis as a country and a people. It is a time to act in the Congress, in your state, and local legislative body, and above all of our daily lives. It is not enough to pin the blame on others, to say this is a problem of one section of the country or another, or to deplore the facts that we face. A great change is at hand, and our task, our obligation, is to make that revolution, that change, peaceful and constructive for all. Those who do nothing are inviting shame as well as violence. Those who act boldly are recognizing right. as well as reality. Next week, I shall ask the Congress of the United States to act, to make a commitment it has not fully made in this century to the proposition that race has no place in American life or law.
And now for something completely different.